Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. My name is Sarah Patterson, and today we'll be talking with Eric Love about his book, Islamophobia and Racism in America. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
Well, to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and I study race, civil rights advocacy organizations, and I use qualitative methods. So I, it's not rocket science, it's sociology. I go and I talk to civil rights advocates about their work. I learn about their strategies. And I'm originally from Detroit. And this is my first book, and it's really just a great pleasure to be able to speak to you about it.
Great. Thank you. So how did this book come about for you?
It really, for me, begins when I was on a study abroad trip in the year 2000, to date myself a little bit. I look a lot older than I actually am, so many of your listeners, if they've seen a photo of me, will be shocked to hear that I was in college in the year 2000. And I went to Jerusalem with this fantastic teacher from Albion College, where I was an undergraduate, Len Berkey, and he led this program called the Great Lakes Jerusalem Program, and it's a very innovative program. We studied with professors from Hebrew University, from Beerzit University, both sides of the Green Line there in Jerusalem. And while I was there, what I realized is that even though I'd been studying, so I was a sociology nerd from the beginning. Declared as a sociology major pretty early. And I realized even though I'd been studying sociology for quite some time, I'd never read anything scholarly about Arab Americans or Muslim Americans or anything like that. And that struck me as odd. So, you know, returning to campus in Michigan under the guidance of Professor Berkey, I started reading some of the great scholarship that's out there, Michael Suleiman, Nadine Naber, many other folks I could mention, started learning more. And then later, a couple years later, when I started graduate school, this is what I'd been reading this kind of on my own. And I was fortunate enough to work with Howard Winant, and in conversations with him over the first few years of graduate school came to this focus on advocacy organizations. And so I just sort of connected this interest that really led me to graduate school with this approach that Howie suggested of looking at the advocacy organizations working with Arab, Muslim, Sikh, and South Asian communities. And so that's how it started, was this research on advocacy organizations connected to this long-standing interest that I'd had in really Arab American, Muslim American civil rights.
So to start us off, your book has a lot of really rich concepts in it. So I was hoping you could start us off by defining some terms, for instance, Middle Eastern, and how we came to that and sort of the problem with using that term.
Yeah. So one of the things I talk about in the book is how difficult it is to talk about Islamophobia because the terms are so inadequate, right? The vocabulary that we have doesn't match up with the lived experiences of people that are affected by Islamophobia. And so what I'm talking about here is how Islamophobia, if you take that term literally, or you break it up into its parts, it means irrational fear of Islam, right? Or fear of Muslims, basically. And that doesn't really capture the structural discrimination, hate crimes, all of the many different things that go into creating this phenomenon that we call Islamophobia. It's not just irrational fear. It's deeper than that. And so with that, you know, one of the first things I talk about in the book is how difficult it is to talk about how Islamophobia, for example, affects more than just Muslim American communities. Of course, Muslims are affected very deeply by Islamophobia, but so too are Sikh Americans, Arab Americans who are Christian and Jewish and, agnostic. It's not just about religion, although religion is a big part of it. It really, for me, it's very much about race and racism. And so what we have here is, I call it a racial paradox in the book. And what I mean by that is we have a situation where the racial category exists. This racial category, like all of them, socially constructed, It captures all these different communities: Arabs, Sikhs, South Asians, various groups of Muslim Americans. They're all swept into this racial image of what it, you know, supposedly looks like to be Muslim, right? Of course, it should go without saying there's no way to actually look Muslim. Muslims, you know, you can look Muslim no matter who you are. You can be a Muslim. It's a religion. And of course, you know, we're talking about over a billion people, millions of people in the U.S. And there's no way to say that, you know, they all look a certain way. And yet, you know, this is the terrible magic and the awesome power of race, is it ignores all that diversity and says, you know, if you look a certain way, you must fit this social identity. That's race, right? And so what I say in the book, this racial paradox, is even though that racial category is there, we can see it with the effect of hate crimes and discrimination. We don't have a way to talk about it. It's trapped in this paradox. It's there and yet it isn't. There's no term for it. Other racial categories that are, you know, as clear as this one is, socially constructed groups, we have terms that we can use as a shorthand. Asian American, for example, there's no clear boundary of who is and who isn't Asian, like who fits in that racial category. It doesn't really work, of course, and really none of them do. Who is white? Who isn't? You know, like that. All the racial categories break down like this, and yet we still have terms for various reasons that, you know, that I try to talk about a little bit in the book. But we haven't yet found that one term that works for this collection of groups that's most affected by Islamophobia because of racism. So I say in the book, you know, it's not a perfect term, but I go with Middle Eastern and Middle Eastern American. It really is not a great term at all. But I say to try to have a discussion about what's actually happening, let's just use this term for now. Let's say Middle Eastern and Middle Eastern American. That way, hopefully we can at least have a little bit of a discussion without falling back into this paradox. Why don't we try to just talk about some of the dynamics that are in play here?
So one of the things you talked about in the book is this tendency to deny race and racism. So the colorblind ideology that we saw when Obama was elected. And so I was wondering if you could talk more about that, as well as this insistence that race and religion are not tied together.
One of the things that makes it very difficult to even talk about what's happening, much less what we should do about it. What's happening with Islamophobia is this tendency in the U.S. where Americans really want to believe they live in a society where racism is slowly but surely fading away, where, yeah, sure, there are maybe a couple of bad apples here and there, but overall, people tend to think America is getting better with regards to racism. And so it's uncomfortable to realize that that's not at all true, that racism gets worse. And it has been getting worse for quite some time in ways that we can talk about and point to very specifically. And so one of the things that this colorblindness, of course, described in great detail by a number of sociologists, this colorblindness ideology, which is this willful ignorance about race and racism. The idea is if just talking about race makes it worse. If we could just all pretend it doesn't exist, then things would be a lot better, you know, almost overnight. This, you know, the false hope that colorblindness presents, one of the ways that it affects the discussion about Islamophobia is in any given moment when Islamophobia manifests. Let's say there's a horrible hate crime. Let's say that there's a policy like a surveillance of a particular Muslim American community or something like this. The racial element that's active in those moments, in the construction of that policy and the effects of that hate crime, are often ignored. And there's many reasons for that. Very often religion is very much part of the reason why that hate crime happened or the reason why that policy was structured the way that it was. And so what happens is Americans will very often take any excuse they can to say, well, this isn't about race. It's about this other thing, right? So if there's some other factor, whether that's gender or class or religion, any other factor that they can point to and say, ah, you see, that's not racism. You see, it's really about this thing here. It's actually about, you know, gender or class. And rather than, you know, talking about all the complex ways that these are intersectional issues, the way that these different factors are all involved all simultaneously, Americans will just say, well, race isn't really the problem then, or they won't even mention the racial aspect. It'll just be ignored. And instead what's discussed is the religious aspect or the gender aspect or some others. And then, of course, there are many who will simply say, well, it's not discriminatory at all, that this is just necessary because of the times that we live in, some argument like this. And so then what happens is discussions about race and racism simply aren't happening. And we end up in a place like where we are now, where we have Islamophobia seemingly expanding, spinning out of control in American society with very little pushback against it. I think this happens in large part because the discussion about race and racism, it just isn't happening the way that it needs to.
So you bring up the idea of racial formation theory, and I was hoping you could tell the listeners more about that, as well as how you sort of see policies and court cases or these structural factors mattering for Islamophobia.
What I try to talk about in this part of the book is the way that again, it gets to the complexity of race when it comes to, in particular, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, there's this history where, the very first naturalization law passed by the U.S. Congress in the 1790s, it set a racial prerequisite. You had to be white to become a naturalized citizen, with very few exceptions. And so what that means, and that law, by the way, was in effect until the 1950s. I mean, it just is, it's just amazing. And so there's a lot of amazing scholarship on, in particular, Arab American immigrants who began coming in large numbers with the Industrial Revolution at the end of the 1800s and into the 1900s. And what they had to do was, as they tried to gain citizenship, was go to courtrooms and say and argue before a court that they were in fact white. So we see, and I talk about in the book how the Syrians, as they were called collectively at the time, would go into various courtrooms around the country, and sometimes they'd be declared white, other times they'd be declared non-white, and they link in with various other arguments. There's this infamous Supreme Court case, United States versus Thind, where a naturalized citizen from India, his citizenship was revoked by the Supreme Court. All of these various, they're called the racial prerequisite cases of immigrants, and many of them from what we would today call the Middle East, coming into the U.S. and trying to gain citizenship, trying to gain that status, and being frustrated by this racial prerequisite situation. And so things changed after the 1950s and 60s as the explicitly racist parts of immigration policy were removed. But that, of course, sets in motion a whole other set of immigration policies that are racialized in very powerful ways. But yeah, I think this history links in with this this racial paradox that I talk about, where many Arab American communities, they go back many generations. You can talk to a lot of Arab American families today and find that they're in their fourth or fifth generation. Full disclosure, I'm extremely white. I'm one of the whitest people that I know. My family is in about its fourth generation, right? And so, we consider ourselves white. My family is almost entirely European. But you can imagine someone from an Arab American family whose, let's say, great-grandfather immigrated in the early 1900s, was a U.S. citizen, was declared white. And you can imagine it's very easy for families like that to feel, yeah, they're white. You know, they're just as white. They're just as American as anybody else. And so this idea that there's some racial category that they're supposed to relate to is a real challenge for many Arab American and Muslim American families as well. So this is, again, it just adds to this complexity of what I call the racial paradox in the book.
So I was wondering if you could talk to us more about how you see Islamophobia developing in America specifically.
Yeah, so of course, we're not going to be able to get into everything here. And in the book, of course, it really just skims the surface of this history. But really, what I try to say is that there's this, and what I try to do is link it up with the development of racism in America, and in specific, the ideology of white supremacy, right? This ideology that white people are somehow better than other racial groups. And that what I show in the book is how that ideology, white supremacy, is developing at the same time, and in many ways, it's developing together with Islamophobia. Of course, it wasn't called Islamophobia until recent years, It's been called, or versions of it have been called, other things like like Orientalism. And what we see is, you know, you look at the history of European conquest and colonization of various Muslim majority countries, and then the decolonization movements in the 20th century, to skip over, you know, hundreds of years of history. And what we see is this dehumanization, and, you know, all of the hallmarks of racism are there in various stages, in various different forms, throughout these many hundreds of years of the relationships between various empires, from Europe, from what we call the Middle East today, and the way that the relationships there and the knowledge that's produced, as Edward Said described in his book, Orientalism, the way that knowledge is produced about the Orient or the Middle East, and how that knowledge is then transmitted to the United States, how it becomes sort of taken for granted, this false stereotypes of, you know, the Orient or the Middle East as this backward, atavistic place, hedonistic, all these, you know, these kinds of negative, dehumanizing stereotypes about people that live or people who have heritage in that region. And then those stereotypes are reproduced in various forms in the U.S. in popular culture, in particular, in the earliest Hollywood films. There's these ridiculous stereotypes. These are reproduced all the way up through to the present in various television and film productions. And then the development of various discriminatory policies that in many ways reinforce these stereotypes. Discriminatory policing, surveillance, all these things, they all get caught up in this. And so we're really, the stage is very full already by the time we reach the 1990s, and concern about Al-Qaeda and other, you know, terrorist groups reaches kind of a boiling point. And then, of course, the September 11th attacks and then the hysteria around various, the lone wolf, quote unquote, lone wolf and sleeper cells and all this kind of hysteria that we saw over the last decade or so. And then Islamophobia used as a campaign strategy in electoral politics. It's kind of a regular feature of American politics in the last, say, 15 years or so. And we're that leads us to the present moment where, again, as I argue in the book, as I said a moment ago, Islamophobia really is spiraling out of control in the United States in really disturbing and dangerous ways.
Well, I sort of want to get into these interviews you did with the advocates. And in your book, you talk about this idea that there's a debate sort of whether to tie Islamophobia to race or not, even within the advocacy community. So I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Yeah. So what I really wanted to talk about with this project was the way that that advocates, the way that Arab, Muslim, Sikh, and South Asian American advocates, how they are developing strategies, how they're working to confront Islamophobia, how they're trying to push back against these trends. And so, yeah, that's what I did, is I went and spoke to something around 60 advocates over the period of a few years, and just learned about how they are approaching this very challenging topic. And really what I expected, you know, I suppose naively, is I expected to find what the sociological theory around civil rights advocacy and what we learn from the history of various civil rights movements in the 20th century. I really expected to see something similar happening with these communities. What I expected when I set out about 10 years ago or so, what I expected to see coalitions forming with umbrella organizations helping to bring together or trying to bring together Arab and Muslim and Sikh and South Asian advocates into coalitions that were durable and were trying to pool resources and respond collectively to what affects all of those communities very directly because of racism. And to me, the closest parallel is probably the Asian American movement of the 1970s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, where one moment in the book that I'd like to highlight is I talk about, and it's, as we're recording this, we're commemorating the 35th anniversary of this moment in the early 80s, where in Detroit, my hometown, a Chinese-American man, Vincent Chin, was brutally beaten to death by some disgruntled auto workers who saw in Vincent Chin a Japanese symbol of the decline of the American auto industry. And this became a catalyzing moment for not just Chinese and not just Japanese Americans, but for Asian Americans. And there was this, and some of the amazing scholarship by people like Yenli Espiritu and Dina Okamoto, they chart how through the work done before and after the Vincent Chin murder, how they worked to bring together disparate groups of Asian Americans and to really launch this Asian American idea, the idea of Asian American as an identity, as a politically powerful identity, as a way to bring together resources and to drive these coalitions. And so what I expected to see when I was setting out to study these advocacy groups working on Islamophobia was something similar to that, where there would be advocates saying, hey, you know, you might be Sikh, I might be Muslim, this guy over here might be an Arab Christian, but we're all affected similarly by Islamophobia, so why don't we work together on this? And, you know, I did see some coalition work, but not anything like what was happening with Asian Americans in the 70s and 80s. The groups largely, you know, stick to themselves. They, you know, they engage in what I call this kind of like ad hoc coalition building, transactional rather than transformational, as I describe in the book. And that came as a real surprise. So then really what I set out to talk about is, you know, what that means, that there is so little coalition work happening here, how it is that it came to be like this. And that really kind of animates the analysis that I try to present.
So then in the book, you talk more about the advocacy agencies and sort of coalition building. So I was hoping you could talk more sort of about the strategies that they're using, as well as the conversations they were having with you.
Yeah. So the main thing that I saw in the interviews that I did was a sort of advocacy that conforms largely. And again, I want to say there are important exceptions, and I detail this in the book, but by and large, what I saw was Middle Eastern American advocates conforming largely to the colorblindness ideology, where they didn't talk about race and racism very much in their advocacy work. So what I mean here is when they would write a press release to denounce a particular policy, when they would hold an event to talk about a particular problem, in most of the public-facing work that they did, they didn't use the terms race and racism. They used other frameworks, religion, religious freedom. They kind of talked about the problem of Islamophobia as one of, look, you know, these communities are just like every other American. So a really good example is several of the organizations that I study. They put the word American first, right? They say American Muslim or American Arab. And the idea there is, okay, if we do that, what we're emphasizing is we're just as American as everyone. We're not claiming any kind of, and in doing this with this strategy, they don't claim any kind of connection to the aggrieved minority groups like African Americans, like Latinx communities, or any others. What they're saying is we are basically just the same as white people, right? To oversimplify a bit, is they're trying to say, look, we should be treated the same as Christians. We should be treated the same as the Italians, right? Or, you know, it's just another group of mainstream Americans who happen to be Muslim or happen to be Sikh or happen to be Arab. And we, therefore, discrimination shouldn't happen. And that's a different strategy than, you know, what I talk about as this kind of like the way the civil rights movements were happening in the 1900s, where it's about pointing to racism specifically and using that very moral claim that racism is wrong to say that, you know, our communities are being attacked because of how we look. It's racism. If you think that racism against, for example, African Americans is wrong, then you have to think that racism against our communities is wrong as well. And what I saw was much less of that kind of a strategy and those kinds of arguments. So that to me was, I think, indicative of a number of different trends that I point to in the book. One of the biggest ones, of course, being colorblindness. The way that it's become just sort of taken for granted that the way to argue for civil rights more generally in the U.S. is to use a colorblind approach, to not really talk about race and racism directly, but instead to kind of dance around it, to use other frameworks to talk about discrimination without bringing up the controversial, thorny issue of race. And this is something that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, using racism was the approach taken for granted, using the language of, you know, this is racist, because it had such a powerful moral and a very politically powerful message behind it. When a group claimed that racism was happening, you know, there was Democrats and Republicans, people across the political spectrum would say, okay, we don't want this, society should not tolerate racism. Let's do something about this. And what I say is, you know, let's say since the 1990s or so, that kind of claim is no longer automatically powerful. Instead, it's controversial. It violates the kind of colorblindness, the normal way that you talk about things is through this colorblindness framework. And so it's much more difficult to make those sorts of claims.
So here to sort of finish off the book, I was hoping you could talk to us about the big picture, as well as sort of the takeaways that you had from the book. For instance, in the conclusion chapter, I really liked this quote from an advocate you spoke to who said, "It's imperative that we row in sync." So I was hoping you could talk more about what you sort of see the big picture as being.
Oh, well, what I try to do in the conclusion is point out and try to pull back and say, okay, what are the experiences of Middle Eastern American, of Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian American advocates? You know, if it were really true that Americans wanted to live in a society where racism wasn't a big deal anymore, then the work that they've done should be pretty easy, right? Like, they should be able to simply say, hey, you know, this isn't cool, and things should change pretty quickly. And of course, what we've seen is that their work is anything but easy. It's been extremely difficult, and it's getting more difficult all the time, it seems. And so what I say is that carries very profound implications for how civil rights advocacy works, or perhaps more accurately, how it doesn't work in general in the U.S. today. And what that means for, you know, if we really do want to be a society where racism is not a big deal anymore, then that needs to change. These advocates are, you know, they're on the front lines. They're working hard every day to try to push back against these problems. And we should be trying to make the work easier for them, not more difficult. And the other thing I do is I basically try to say, look, you know, you got to go read some of the work of these other amazing scholars, these incredible scholars that have done so much work on this question exactly, is what does a 21st century civil rights movement look like? So I point to Michelle Alexander, Deepa Iyer, and a few other folks and say, look, what they talk about here is like what that advocate that you quoted there says, is we need to row in sync, that the way that civil rights movements happened in the 1960s and in the 1900s, it's not going to be the same as we push back against problems like mass incarceration and police violence and Islamophobia, which are very much inextricably linked. These all stem from the same root. The root is white supremacy. As we try to find ways to build coalitions that can push back against those things, it's going to require that we row in sync, that we find creative ways to transcend the politics of the moment and to bring together groups that don't often come together, to build those coalitions, even though that's very difficult and painstaking work. That's the kind of work that a 21st century civil rights movement is going to, that's what it'll look like when it starts to be more successful than it has been in the last, 15 years or so.
Great. Thanks again so much for being with us today. I was hoping you could talk to us about what you're currently working on.
Yeah, sure. So I really want to continue doing what I did for this book, which is talking to civil rights advocates, learning about the strategies that they're developing. And so I'm doing that. I've been fortunate enough over the past couple of years to launch a new project where I'm talking to advocates that are working on an issue that's very much defined by race and racism. And the issue is public transportation. And so I've been speaking to advocates in cities around the country and just talking to them about, you know, that's another issue like Islamophobia where the racism is often ignored or kind of talked about as a side effect rather than as the foundational element of how transportation systems in America, how they were developed, is very much about racism, right? And so I want to learn how those advocates that are trying to improve public transportation in American cities, how they navigate those racial politics, how they find strategies to try to, you know, to push back against that racism and find ways to move improvements for public transportation forward. So I've been working on that for a couple of years now, and hopefully somebody is listening to this podcast in the not too distant future, and they could maybe see some of the work that I'm hoping to develop on that right now. So I'm working on that, and of course continuing to follow the very disturbing developments around Islamophobia, and but yeah, basically I'm, you know, I hope to continue doing work around civil rights advocacy in the United States.
That sounds really interesting. So thanks again for being with us today, Eric.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Thanks again, and catch us next time on New Books in Sociology.